irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Marvin Smith, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and I'm flying solo today. But every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, we will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising your children today and in our constantly changing future. Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. As I'm sure many of you expected to hear Marvin's voice with me this morning, we're reminded of the reality of what he does when he's not on the air. Today, he's helping to improve how we educate our young people through the charter school system. And I appreciate Marvin's willingness. He's always there to help. Now, speaking of education, from childhood, we're taught one central, non-controversial idea about morality. Self-sacrifice is a virtue. It's universally accepted that serving the needs of others rather than our own is the essence of morality. It's to be ethical. It is believed. It is to be altruistic. Questioning this belief is regarded as tantamount to questioning the self-evident. Today, our guest questions it. His book, In Defense of Selfishness, refutes widespread misconceptions about the meaning of selfishness and the meaning of altruism. He demonstrates that genuine selfishness is exemplified by truly selfish individuals who are committed to moral principles and lives that are honest, productive, and self-respecting of life. Our guest today is Peter Schwartz. Peter is a former chairman of the board and currently a distinguished fellow of the Ayn Rand Institute. He writes and lectures extensively on topics ranging from ethics and political philosophy to environmentalism and multiculturalism. Mr. Schwartz is also the author of The Foreign Policy of Self-Interest, A Moral Ideal for America, Libertarianism, The Perversion of Liberty, and The Battle of Laissez-Faire Capitalism. Now, Peter was the founding editor and publisher of The Intellectual Activist, a periodical that covered political and social issues from a pro-individual rights orientation. And he was president and editor-in-chief of Second Renaissance Books, a publisher and distributor of titles promoting the value of reason, individualism, science, technology, and capitalism. Lastly, he is the editor and contributing author of Ayn Rand's Return to Primitive and co-editor of Objectively Speaking, Ayn Rand Interviewed. Peter, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you, Alan. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I am very glad to have you, and I've been reading your book, In Defense of Selfishness, and I read about 40 books a year, and I want to tell all of my listeners, if you only get a chance to read one, read this one. This is truly one of the best books I've read in a long time. And as many of you know, because I talk about it, I read books at the gym, where people often come up and ask me, because I'm sitting on the same bike, pedaling away while I'm reading. And they come up and they ask, they go, well, what's the topic of your show this week? And when I show them the book, or I say, it's In Defense of Selfishness, I've gotten some pretty strange looks. So, Peter, let's start with, how is selfishness misdefined?
Yes, that's a good place to start, because if you ask almost anybody what selfishness means, the answer you'll get typically is, well, selfishness is somebody, some amoral predator, somebody who victimizes other people, somebody like a a Bernie Madoff or Attila the Hun, people who just are willing to do anything, to lie, to cheat, to kill, in order to gratify their whims. Now, that is the common view of selfishness, and it's a wrong view.
Mm-hmm.
Selfishness means simply being concerned with your own interests, being concerned with your own life. Now, look around you. There are many people who pursue their own values, try to advance their own interests without victimizing others. I mean, it ranges from, let's say, a student, a diligent student who chooses to spend his time studying rather than give in to the pleas of his fraternity brothers to help them go partying, or an entrepreneur who ignores people who tell him to just go for the fast buck and instead endures years of struggle to create a superior product and get rich, or an artist who refuses to compromise and dedicates himself to producing a work that meets his independent standards. Now, these are all examples of selfishness, of selfishness properly understood, that is, of people who value their own lives, value their own well-being, and take the action necessary to sustain their lives, to improve their lives, to advance their goals, but they do so without victimizing others. Their gain does not come at the expense of others, and that is what selfishness genuinely means.
Yeah, and I love the way that you explain that, and the thought that comes to mind while you were explaining that, when you mentioned about, you know, the student that chooses to, as some people would say, selfishly focus on whatever it is that is his study. I mean, what if his level of study is medicine, and what if this becomes the next person who finds a cure for cancer? You know, was he selfish? Yes. Was he selfish that he didn't, you know, go out and drive his buddies around because they needed a designated driver or whatever? So yes,
exactly. That's exactly right. I would go one step further. I would say, he should proudly say, yes, I am being selfish. I am dedicated to my goals and improving my life and living according to my own standards. As a consequence, other people benefit. If he becomes a doctor or he becomes a poet, whatever he decides, he will produce things of value that in a free society other people will benefit from. But that's not his ultimate goal. He doesn't become a doctor or a poet or an entrepreneur to sacrifice himself for the sake of others. He does it for his own benefit, and as a byproduct, other people gain as well. That is the whole, the essence of selfishness is gaining without making other people lose, as opposed to the idea of sacrifice, where one person's gain comes only at the cost of another person's loss.
Well, now, you also mention in your book, and again, the name of the book is In Defense of Selfishness, you describe altruism at times as servitude. How is altruism being misused?
Well, think of what altruism is. Now, altruism does not simply say be kind to your neighbors, help an old lady cross the street. Altruism says you must subordinate your life to others. Your life should not be as important to you as other people. If someone is in need of something and you can provide it, you have a moral duty, according to altruism, to satisfy that person's needs. This is the philosophy underlying our whole welfare state. So, for example, if we have people who need health insurance, if you can pay for it, you have to provide it. If they need their mortgages subsidized, if they need flood insurance, if people in Bangladesh need foreign aid, as long as you are able to provide it, altruism says you have a moral duty to sacrifice. And what does sacrifice mean? Sacrifice means give up your values, your goals, your interests for the sake of others. Subordinate yourself to other people. Others are supposed to have a moral priority over you. And I think that translates into servitude. What else is a servant or a slave except somebody who is not allowed to work for his own interest but must serve his master? Now, altruism doesn't put a gun to your head necessarily, but altruism is moral slavery because it says you don't have a right to exist for your own sake. The moral justification of your life is only the service you provide to others. And I think that's very unjust.
Yeah, and you give a example of this, and I can't remember the gentleman's name, but you refer to a particular gentleman that after winning millions of dollars, he not only gave that away, but he gave away a kidney, and I believe he even got to the point of giving away the second one, which obviously would kill him. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Yes, this man, the man's name is Zell Kravinsky, and this was years ago. He made money as a real estate developer. He was a multimillionaire and decided at one point that he would start taking altruism seriously. So he gave away most of his money. His wife and family were very upset at it. Nonetheless, he did that, and he started to look for other means by which he could implement the code of altruism, the code of self-sacrifice. So he decided one day he would give away a kidney to a stranger simply because he felt it's his duty. He has two kidneys. The other person needs a kidney. Why he should feel a duty to provide it. And he did. Now, his wife pleaded with him not to do it. She said, you know, he wasn't in very good health. Plus, what if his own children one day needed a kidney? He didn't care. He said altruism demands sacrifice, and he was very consistent. He gave away his kidney, and later he even said he would be willing to give away other vital organs of his body because other people's lives are more important than his. Now, this is an extreme example, obviously. Yeah. Very few people do this. But the point is, if you take altruism seriously and you try to implement it consistently, this is what you should do. And just as altruism, in effect, says no one should have two houses until everybody has one, or no one should have two cars until everybody has one, nobody should have two kidneys until everyone has at least one. That is the consistent implementation of altruism.
Well, now, taking that to today, you talk a little bit about, you know, some of the increasing social conflict. How is the problem of this increasing social conflict the result and not the absence of altruism in our lives, but of its overwhelming presence?
Yes, that's an important consequence of altruism that people really should understand. Many people think we're all told that the way to achieve social harmony is to for everybody to adopt altruism, to be his brother's keeper, to sacrifice for your neighbor. Now, the exact opposite is true, because if you have a duty to sacrifice, then everything you have, everything you've honestly earned, every dollar in your pocket and your bank account, belongs by moral right to somebody who has less. You're not entitled to it. The other person is. Everything, every pleasure you take in life, every suit of clothes you buy, every morsel of food you put into your mouth, you should feel guilty about because of all the people who don't have that suit of clothes or that bite of food. And therefore, there's a constant conflict between you and everybody else, between whatever you have and everybody else who has a little bit less, because you're not really entitled to it, someone else is. And as I said, this is the basis of the welfare state, where anybody with a need has a moral claim against you. Anything you can provide, as I said, whether it's somebody's mortgage or somebody's health care or somebody's college tuition, if you can help pay for it, you're morally obligated to do it. Now, that sets up a constant, perpetual conflict between people. And in my view, this is what's causing the protracted conflicts in the world. Within a society, between one country and other countries, it's the idea that you must sacrifice, and there's no end to it. As long as you have something that another person lacks, you will be obligated to sacrifice for that person's sake.
Right, and in some cases, taking that to a kidney.
Yes, exactly. And not only that, but remember, the every society's politics rests on some principle of ethics. And in our society, altruism is the code that's commonly accepted, and therefore we have a burgeoning welfare state where there's ever-increasing demands on people to pay more, to provide more. Anything somebody lacks, you have to pay for, and the government then comes and does, in fact, put a gun to your head and say, you have money, you have to provide for other people. Does it harm you? Well, that's what altruism says. You have to harm yourself for the sake of others in need. Now, in my view, as I said, the opposite is true. The way to achieve social harmony is not by dividing people into two warring classes, into, you know, those who have more and those who have less, but rather to treat everyone as morally equal. That is, the way to deal with people is not by sacrificing one person to another. The way to deal with them is by voluntary trade, by exchanging value for value to mutual benefit, so that one person's gain is another person's gain. And that is the way to achieve social harmony, and there's no conflict among people as long as they all understand that you're entitled to keep what you've honestly earned and you don't have a duty to suffer so that someone else might benefit.
Well, we've got an email comment coming in that reads, this is from a listener, as I was reading the review of your book on the Answers for the Family site, I had to take pause as it greatly resonated with how I feel about the guilt heaped on us. If we don't sacrifice ourselves, and they have this part in caps, for what seems like all that ask. And so, anyways, and then it goes on to say, it says, you know, thank you for your view, as I don't believe that a person is narcissistic just because they have more balanced perspective of self and how they relate to others. I look forward to reading your book, which I purchased yesterday.
Well, I appreciate that. I wouldn't call narcissistic is not the term I would use. I would like to salvage and restore the concept selfishness to its proper meaning. I know that today, anytime you use the word selfish, people cringe. People think there's nothing more horrible than to be accused of selfishness. But the problem is that we've got this package deal. That is, because people associate selfishness with predatory behavior, with, you know, the Bernie Madoff types who feed off the blood of others, because that's what they associate with selfishness, they therefore put into the same package the people who are not victimizers, the people who pursue their own interests without preying on others. And therefore, it's all in one big lump, fuzzy concept, and any time you accuse somebody of acting for his own self-interest, he becomes lumped in with the Attila the Huns and the robbers and the killers. And I've got my view is we need to separate that out. We need to understand that selfishness means pursuing your own interest. How you do it and what constitutes your self-interest is a complicated question which the science of ethics is supposed to answer, but it is not inherent, that is, inherent in selfishness is not the idea of destroying others. Selfishness means pursuing your interest, which you can do without destroying others. In fact, which you can do by trading and benefiting mutually with other people.
Right, and doing it honestly and ethically. Yes. I agree. And I think what the listener was suggesting, or what I got from that comment, was when they said that they don't believe that a person is narcissistic, I think that goes right into what you were saying about them trying to lump people in other categories. They want to lump you in with Attila the Hun, and I think that this person, I get the feeling somebody has tried to lump them in with being a narcissist because they were trying to do something of self-interest. So I think, yes, what they're doing in essence is agreeing with you that that's just another thing that they try to lump on you, you know, if you try to do something that right, that pursues your own interest. Now, you mention in the book you talk about love. So share with us why you say that love is selfish.
Yes, this is another one of the really terrible distortions that the purveyors of altruism foist on us. We're always told love is unselfish. Love is a sacrifice. Now think about that. What does love mean? Love means you find some person and there's something of value in them to you. You find something worthwhile in them. Love is not indiscriminate. Now imagine if love were actually based on altruism, what would it mean? It would mean that you choose somebody at random and you say, okay, I'm going to love you, I'm going to marry you. I have no real, you have no real value to me, but out of pity and out of self-sacrifice, I'm going to, let's get married. Now imagine you told your wife or husband that they're of no value to you, but you're living with them out of pity and self-sacrifice. What kind of insult would that be?
Well, it's also not very romantic.
Absolutely. It's not, because it's not based on anything of real value. Yet, isn't this what altruism demands? When you say love is selfless, love is unselfish, it means you have no self-interest in the person that you love. And that's ridiculous. I mean, I'm married. I love my wife. She's of great value to me. And she's precious to me. Not as against some stranger in the street. I value her because she brings something to my life. She is important to me. She's a value to me. And all of that is very selfish.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And that makes perfect sense to me. You selfishly want to spend time with her because you enjoy that time. You know, you selfishly want to, you know, keep her in your life. You selfishly want to make her happy, you know. How is that a bad thing? I don't know.
Yes, and further, it's a mutual benefit. It's not one-sided, which sacrifice is. It's not as though one party is giving something up so the other person gains. Both people in a proper, loving, rational relationship value each other. Both people benefit from the other's presence. Both people treasure the other and want to live with one another. That is the epitome of a mutually beneficial, selfishly oriented relationship. So selfishness applies both to material relationships and to spiritual relationships such as love or friendship.
All right. Well, the book is called In Defense of Selfishness. We are talking with Peter Schwartz. We're going to take a break. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis.
call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. I'm Alan Cardoza. Our guest today is Peter Schwartz, and we are talking about the defense of selfishness. So if you're just tuning in and you hear that, and you might be saying to yourself, wait a minute, how can you defend selfishness? Well, stay with us and listen, because this really is something that we all need to understand to be able to see how we can look at this in a whole different light. So, Peter, now we were talking when we took a break, we were talking about love and how the fact that love is selfish because it's something that we want and we see for ourselves and because we value that person that we love. Let's talk a little bit about principles now, some of the moral principles, and how by having these principles that that it really shows how we can have this selfish need for these principles and how it works for everybody.
Yes, let me see if I could explain this, and I'd take a couple of minutes to explain this. One of the worst falsehoods that the doctrine of altruism conveys is the idea that the whole realm of ethics, the whole realm of moral principles, pertains only to altruism. And that if you are a selfish person, if you pursue your self-interest, you don't need moral principles. Not only don't you need moral principles, you reject moral principles, because selfishness is supposed to mean do whatever you feel like doing, and if that's the case, why do you need moral principles? Now, in my view, selfishness is not doing whatever you feel like doing, because look at all the people who follow whatever they happen to desire at the moment, and look at how self-destructive they are. Look at, you know, we have people who are alcoholics, drug addicts, masochists, serial murderers. All of these people are acting self-destructively because they're allowing themselves to be guided by their mindless whims rather than by their rational faculty. Now, we're not animals, so we don't have an automatic pre-programmed knowledge of how to sustain our lives. We have to discover it. How do we discover it? By means of reason. We look out in the world and figure out, you know, we need food to live. Let's figure out how to grow crops or how to hunt or how to build a house or how to get medicine to cure diseases. All of these things have to be discovered by reason. Reason is the way in which man survives. That's his basic tool of survival. And therefore, if you're asking, what does a selfish person really need to pursue? He needs to have a commitment to rationality. That is his number one means of sustaining his self-interest, of staying alive. And therefore, he needs to understand that in order to sustain his life, he has to act in accordance with the demands of reality. You know, we have a certain nature. We need food to live. You can't, you know, ingest sand and dirt and live. You can't breathe in carbon monoxide and live. There are many things that reality imposes on us, and we have to therefore live in accordance with the demands of reality. That is the fundamental aspect of self-interest. And then the question is, okay, if we have to live with reality, what principles are required for that? And I think that's exactly what moral principles provide us with. So I'll give you an example.
Okay.
Take honesty. Honesty is not an altruistic value. Honesty is a selfish necessity for living, because honesty says, do not try to fake reality. Your life requires living in compliance with the facts of reality. Dishonesty means you're trying to evade those facts. You're trying to fake those facts. So, let's say a husband who tries to cheat on his wife, is not just fooling his wife. He's consigning himself to live in a counterfeit reality, because everything he does requires hiding certain facts from his wife and from other people, and every lie that he commits requires more lies. So he's constantly finding reality is his enemy. And when you find reality is your enemy, you know you're acting against the basic requirements of human living. So moral principles like honesty or justice or integrity are selfish requirements for living. They are not altruistic virtues.
Now, what about those that would say that there's a conflict of interest at that point, of trying to be a rational individual?
Well, a conflict between what and what, do you mean?
Well, the conflict of interest between, their rationale. So, you know, the fact that they can rationale things that maybe are unearned, and the person that then says, well, you know, no, you haven't earned this, so you know, you haven't earned it, I've earned it, and somebody says, well, yes, you have a conflict of interest because you want it for yourself.
Well, people can have a conflict of desires, but that's not the same as a conflict of interest, because it's in your interest to seek the earned, to earn what you want. It's against your interest to seek the unearned. It's against your interest to be dependent, to be a moocher, a leech on somebody else's efforts. Being a parasite is not in your self-interest. So therefore, if you understand what self-interest actually requires, there's no conflict among rational people. People understand you're entitled to what you've earned. You're not entitled to what you haven't earned. And if you try to seek the unearned, then you're descending into the jungle, and you're trying to live by force and by deceit and by criminality, and that is not in your interest, and people can't live that way in society. If people understood what their actual interest consisted of, there would be no conflicts. Each person would understand what I've earned is mine, what you've earned is yours. I'm not going to try to steal from you, and you're not going to try to steal from me. And that way we have a productive, harmonious society where when we deal with each other, it's to mutual benefit.
Okay. Now, you're talking about public interest at this point. I know that in your book you talk a little bit about the myth. Tell us about the myth of public interest.
Okay, this is an interesting topic, because here's a term, public interest. We hear that tossed around all the time.
Uh-huh.
And if you stop and ask yourself, well, what the hell does public interest actually mean? How do you define what a public interest is as against, you know, a private interest? There is no real way to define it. It's arbitrary, because think of concrete instances of it. We have a public park. Let's say Yellowstone Park is a public park, and it's considered a project that's in the public interest. So people go there, the public benefit. Whereas a private park, let's say Disney World, which is entirely privately owned, is considered not in the public interest. Now, why? Well, they say, well, maybe more people go to Yellowstone. Well, it turns out that about 3 million people a year go to Yellowstone, and about 40 million a year go to Disney World. So why are you a member of the public when you visit Yellowstone Park, but a member of the so-called non-public when you visit Disney World? What distinguishes them? And the only thing in reality that distinguishes, that the thing that characterizes a public interest, is that people are getting something for which they are not paying. So if you go to Yellowstone Park, I think they charge an admission fee, but it doesn't cover the costs of the park, and it's not intended to, because it's not a trade. So who pays for the cost? the people who don't attend, the taxpayers, whether they go to their, whether they go to the park or not, whether they value the park or not, they have to pay. So what happens is in a private project like Disney World, the users pay and the non-users don't pay, which is the rational way to do it. In a public interest project like Yellowstone Park or any of these thousands or millions of government public interest projects, what happens there is that the users don't pay and the non-users have to pay. So it's a complete perversion of justice, but that is what is the defining characteristic, to the extent that you can define something as amorphous as the public interest, the defining characteristic is that you get something for which somebody else pays. And that's, again, another instance of a real injustice.
Mm-hmm. Are you still there?
I'm here. Yeah,
oh,
I'm here.
Okay. I heard a click. Now, you in your book, you mentioned, you know, that, you know, your right to live is not the right to be given the means of living, but rather the right to achieve those means by your own effect without obstruction by others. Where do you believe that government can be of service, and where do you believe government has overstepped its place?
It's very simple. The government is important. You need to have a government, but it has one fundamental function, and that is to protect the rights of its individual citizens. You have a right to make a living, which means you have a right to find an employer who wants to hire you, and he has a right to hire you if he so chooses. You make a trade. The government has no role there. But, or just like you have the right to medical care does not mean that you have a right to have somebody else pay you for your medical care. It means that if you want to go to see a doctor and he's willing to see you, you make a willing exchange. Government has no role there. So the only justification for government involvement is when somebody's rights are being violated. And there's only one way in which rights are violated, and that's by force. Or by fraud, which is an indirect use of force. So if somebody, you know, robs you, then the government has to come in, the police have to come in and either, you know, stop the robbery or find them and arrest them and try to make restitution to you. But the use of force, once force is initiated by somebody against an innocent party, then the government has a role. It has to step in effect in self-defense. It has to use force in retaliation against the criminal who initiated it. And the same applies to, you know, foreign entities that threaten us. If you have foreign nations that attack us, the government has a military which is supposed to defend us. But that's all. The only occasion for government involvement is when force has been initiated or the threat of force has been initiated. Then the government has to step in and use force to defend us. But it has no role anywhere else. If private individuals voluntarily deal with one another or voluntarily choose not to deal with one another, that should be their decision, and the government should not step in and prevent that decision from taking place. So there should be no role for government in education, in health care, in transportation. Government, there should be, let's put it this way, the government, there should be a separation of between the government and the economy in the same way that there should be a separation between state and church. Those two don't mix, and the economy and government don't mix either. Each should be left to the decisions and the actions of private, voluntary individuals.
Well, two of the points that you just brought up were education and medicine. So let's talk a little bit about those. Where, from the standpoint of starting with education, you know, when you say governments shouldn't be involved, and again, I'm not a big fan of what government is putting out right now in that area. Obviously, we need to be a well-educated society, and and that helps us compete in the world market. So to what level should we have government involvement, and to what level should they stay away?
We should have zero level of government involvement and 100% staying away. The idea that, well, we need education, so maybe there's a role for government. Well, we need food, so do we need government to take over the farms and grow our crops? Who's going to? Which is a more reliable source of food, private farmers or government-imposed collectivized farming? And you look at all the socialist countries that have tried it, and they can't feed their own citizens. And the same applies to education. There's no basis for thinking that we need government simply because education is a value, we need government to get involved. It's precisely because it is such a value to us that government has to stay out. Let private individuals build private schools, and parents will decide on their own which schools to send their kids to. The schools will become accountable. We won't have this mass illiteracy that we have now, because in government schools, there's no penalty for having an incompetent school, a school that doesn't actually teach kids what it's supposed to. Nothing happens to the people. There's no ramifications, no consequences from incompetence. They just perpetuate themselves, and it all depends on politics. Whereas in a private market, if you have a bad school, parents go to a different school, and the school closes down, loses money, goes out of business. So there's no reason to treat education any differently than any other business. If it's a value, if people demand it, it would be provided, and be provided 100 times better than the government public school system does today.
And then from the standpoint of medicine, when we get to that point in which we have people that are unable to, to care for themselves, or are unable to do that. At what point, should we have government involvement?
Well, again, I don't. Charity can be perfectly legitimate. People can willingly provide charity for people that they think deserve their help. People who are innocent victims of some misfortune through no fault of their own, you can do that. But again, there's no reason a government has to tell you, put a gun to your head and say, you must pay for this person's support. The fact that somebody can't help himself is sometimes very tragic, but in a free society, there will always be philanthropic organizations that help people who are genuinely unable to help themselves, and are just, as I say, innocent victims of some misfortune. There will always be these private charities, and in fact, if you had a proper government, which would be a government about maybe 5% the size it is today, all of the taxes and direct and indirect taxation that government exacts from you would stay in your pocket, and there'd be much more money available for people to voluntarily give to whatever charities they think are worthwhile. It should be your choice. If you want to help a charity, it should be your choice. It should not be a legally mandated requirement.
Now, when I just looked, and we've only got about 5 more minutes, but you have said that your primary concern is the value of individual rights, which could lead to a government that actively defends our rights against domestic or foreign threats. How do you believe we can get to that point? I mean, it makes sense, but at the same time, how can we get there if we start taking steps in that direction?
Well, any political change that you want to achieve, particularly a radical political change, which is what we're talking about, requires first a radical change in people's idea of morality. Politics is based on morality. We implement political programs based on what we think is morally right or morally wrong. And to get people to support the idea of a government that defends individual rights and does nothing else requires people to change their view of what is morally right and morally wrong. And that's what my book is about. I think if people understand that you're alive, you have one life, it should be precious to you. You should have a moral right to live for your own sake rather than become a servant to the needs of others. If people understood that what rational selfishness was and understood why it was good and why the idea of self-sacrifice is unjust and destructive, then they would be amenable to the idea of government allowing people to live, allowing people to choose their values, to pursue their goals, to pursue their own happiness, and not to be compelled to sacrifice what they've achieved and earned for the sake of those who haven't achieved it and haven't earned it. We would have, if we had a proper ethics, we would have a proper system of government.
Well, we've got another question that's come in from a listener, and this one reads, "My mother, who was raised during the Depression, is a true martyr in every sense of the word. Living with us and in her 80s, we are very challenged by her criticism of our children and what she calls their," and this is in quotes, "spoilt," and it is spelt with a T, "selfishness. Actually, our two teens are wonderful young people with the normally healthy exploration and desire to assert their own personalities. We are a fortunate family, but not in her eyes. How do you view my mother's generation and the new one? Do you believe we are going in the right direction as a society? And what influence have you found your book to have on these two different generations?"
Well, it's very hard to answer that because it's hard to know exactly what she means by the accusation of selfishness. If she means that your children are being selfish in the conventional sense, not in the sense that I use the term, that is,
right,
they're just spoiled brats, they just do whatever they want, they're in effect little Attila the Huns growing up, well, that is not selfishness, and that means that they haven't been brought up properly. But if by selfishness she means the proper idea of selfishness that I'm advocating, that they have values and they want to pursue it and they don't want to, you know, give up their toys for the brat next door who always breaks it whenever you lend them something, then they're being brought up properly. So make sure when you use the term selfishness you understand the context in which you mean it, because rational selfishness means you valuing your life and being unwilling to live as a servant for the needs of others.
And you know what? And I think that's great, because I think, again, what this mother should tell her mother and probably her kids is, you know, I appreciate your rational selfishness if that's the case. And that's a way that they can start making that shift as well. Again, to tell everybody, we're just about out of time. The book is Defense of Selfishness, Why the Code of Self-Sacrifice is Unjust and Destructive.
If people want my website, can I give you my website?
Yeah, I was just going to give that. PeterSchwartz.com, PeterSchwartz.com. Go to the website, order the book. Again, I highly recommend it. If you're driving and you couldn't write that down, go to our website, Answers, the numeral for the family. We will have Peter's information there. You'll be able to not only listen to this again, but you'll also be able to pull up information on how to reach Peter. Peter, thank you so much. I appreciate this. I look forward to talking to you more.
I'll wait
and
here.
Please let me know when the next book comes out.
Absolutely. Thanks for the opportunity.
You're very welcome. All right. And for everybody out there, thank you so much. And tune in next week when our guest, Christy Woodson Harvey, will discuss her new novel, Dear Caroline, which explores the topic of adoption and one of the most difficult decisions two mothers could ever make. Now, if you missed a show or you want to share this show with your friends, please visit our archives at, again, answers4thefamily.com. And the next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page and like us. Again, for everybody, be good humans and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Marvin Smith, right here on LA Talk Radio.